or not using a heavy blanket while you sleep could help too. This hasn't gone unnoticed by the health and wellness industry. Being cold is hot right now. Cryotherapy, a few minutes in a box super-chilled to minus 110 degrees Celsius or minus 166 degrees Fahrenheit, is an increasingly popular method of inducing a helping of this sort of stress to our bodies, although the research is still a ways away from being conclusive as to how, why, and even whether it truly works. That didn't stop me from accepting an invitation from Joe Rogan, the media mogul and comedian, to go with him to a cryotherapy spa. 3 minutes standing in my underwear at Mars temperatures may have activated my brown fat and all the great health benefits that go with that. At the very least, it left me invigorated and grateful to be alive. As with most things in life, it's probably best to change your lifestyle when you are young, because making brown fat becomes harder as you get older. If you choose to expose yourself to the cold, moderation will be key. Similar to fasting, the greatest benefits are likely to come for those who get close to, but not beyond, the edge. Hypothermia is not good for our health, neither is frostbite, but goosebumps, chattering teeth, and shivering arms aren't dangerous conditions. They're simply signs that you're not in Sydney. And when we experience these conditions often enough, our longevity genes get the stress they need to order up some additional healthy fat. What happens on the other side of the thermostat? The picture is a bit less clear, but we have some promising leads from our friend S. Cerevisiae. We know from work in my lab that raising the temperature of yeast from 30 degrees Celsius to 37 degrees Celsius, just below the limits of what those single-celled organisms can sustain, turns on the PNC1 gene and boosts their NAD production so their SIRT2 proteins can work that much harder. What's fascinating is not so much that these temperature-stressed cells live 30% longer, but that the mechanism was the same as that evoked by calorie restriction. Is heat good for human bodies too? Possibly, but not exactly in the same way. Because we are warm-blooded animals, our enzymes haven't evolved a tolerance for large changes in temperature. You can't just raise your core body temperature and expect to live longer. But as my northern German wife Sandra likes to point out, there are a lot of benefits to exposing your skin and lungs to high temperatures, at least temporarily. Continuing an ancient Roman tradition, many northern and eastern Europeans regularly partake in sauna bathing for relaxation and health reasons. The Finns are the most dedicated, with the majority of men reporting using a sauna once a week, year-round. Sandra tells me it's pronounced sauna, not sauna, and that no home should be without one. I'm sticking with sauna to avoid sounding like a schnickelfritz, but when it comes to housing construction, Sandra may be onto something. A 2018 study conducted in Helsinki found that physical function, vitality, social functioning, and general health were significantly better among sauna users than non-users. Although the researchers were correct to point out that part of the effect could be due to the fact that those who are sick or disabled don't go to the sauna. A more convincing study followed a group of more than 2,300 middle-aged men from eastern Finland for more than 20 years. Those who used a sauna with great frequency, up to 7 times a week, enjoyed a 2-fold drop in heart disease, fatal heart attacks, and all-cause mortality events over those who heat bathed once per week. None of the sauna studies dug deep enough to tell us why temporary heat exposure may be so good for us. If yeast is any guide, NAMPT, the gene in our bodies that recycles NAD, may be in on the act. NAMPT is turned on by a variety of adversity triggers, including fasting and exercise, which makes more NAD so the sirtuins can work hard at making us healthier. We have never tested if NAMPT is turned on by heat, but that would be something to do. Either way, one thing is clear. It does us little good to spend our entire lives in the thermo-neutral zone. Our genes didn't evolve for a life of pampered comfort. A little stress to induce hormesis once in a while likely goes a long way. But dealing with biological adversity is one thing. Overwhelming genetic damage is another. Don't rock the landscape. A bit of adversity or cellular stress is good for our epigenome because it stimulates our longevity genes. It activates AMPK, turns down mTOR, boosts NAD levels, and activates the sirtuins, the disaster response teams, to keep up with the normal wear and tear that comes from living on planet Earth. But normal is the operative word, because when it comes to aging, normal is bad enough. When our sirtuins have to respond to many disasters, especially those that cause double-strand DNA breaks, these epigenetic signalers are forced to leave their posts and head to other places on the genome where DNA breaks have occurred. Sometimes they make their way back home, sometimes they don't. We can't prevent all DNA damage, and we wouldn't want to because it's essential for the function of the immune system and even consolidating our memories. But we do want to prevent extra damage, and there's a lot of extra damage to be had out there. Cigarettes, for starters. There aren't many legal vices out there that are worse for your epigenome than the deadly concoction of thousands of chemicals smokers put into their bodies every day. There's a reason why smokers seem to age faster. They do age faster. The DNA damage that results from smoking keeps the DNA repair crews working overtime, and likely the result is the epigenetic instability that causes aging. And although I'm not likely to be the first person you'll hear this from, it nonetheless bears repeating. Smoking is not a private, victimless activity. The levels of DNA-damaging aromatic amines in cigarette smoke are about 50 to 60 times as high in secondhand smoke as in firsthand smoke. If you do smoke, it's worth trying to quit. Don't smoke? That's great. But even without smoke, there's fire. In much of the developed world, and increasingly in the developing world as well, we're practically bathing in DNA-damaging chemicals. In some places, cities with lots of people and lots of cars especially, the simple act of breathing is enough to do extra damage to your DNA. But it would also be wise to be wary of the PCBs and other chemicals found in plastics, including many plastic bottles and takeout containers. Avoid microwaving these. It releases even more PCBs. Exposure to azo dyes, such as aniline yellow, which is used in everything from fireworks to the yellow ink in home printers, can also damage our DNA. And organohalides, compounds that contain substituted halogen atoms and are used in solvents, degreasers, pesticides, and hydraulic fluid, can also wreak havoc on our genomes. Nobody in his right mind would purposefully ingest solvents, degreasers, pesticides, and hydraulic fluid, of course, but there's plenty of damage to be had in some of the things we do intentionally eat and drink. We've known for more than half a century that N-nitroso compounds are present in food treated with sodium nitrite, including some beers, most cured meats, and especially cooked bacon. In the decades since, we've learned that these compounds are potent carcinogens. What we've also come to understand is that cancer is just the start of our nitrate-treated woes, because nitroso compounds can inflict DNA breakage as well, sending those overworked sirtuins back to work some more. Then there's radiation. Any source of natural or human-inflicted radiation, such as UV light, X-rays, gamma rays, and radon in homes, which is the second most frequent cause of lung cancer besides smoking, can cause additional DNA damage, necessitating the call-up of an epigenetic fix-it team. As someone who flies a lot for work, I think about this quite a bit, every time I go through security, in fact. Most of the research on the current versions of airport scanners suggests that they probably don't do tremendous damage to our DNA, but there's been little attention given to their long-term impact on our epigenome and the aging process. No one has ever tested what a mouse looks like 2 years after being repeatedly exposed to these devices. The ice mice tell us that chromosome tickling is all that's needed to accelerate aging. I'm aware the radiation exposure from millimeter wave scanners is lower than that from previous scanners. The security attendants at the machine tell travelers the exposure is about the same as the flight. But with millions of flight miles under my belt, why would I want to double the damage? Whenever possible, I take the pre-check line or ask for a pat-down instead. If all of this makes you feel as if it's impossible to completely avoid DNA breaks and the epigenetic consequences of those breaks, well, that's true. The natural and necessary act of replicating DNA causes DNA breaks, trillions of them, throughout your body every day. You can't avoid radon particles or cosmic rays, unless you live in a lead box at the bottom of the ocean. And even if you were to move to a desert island, the fish you'd have to eat would likely contain mercury, PCBs, PBDEs, dioxins, and chlorinated pesticides, all of which can damage your DNA. In our modern world, even with the most natural lifestyle you can follow, this sort of DNA damage is inevitable. No matter how old you are, even if you're a teenager, it is already happening to you. DNA damage has accelerated your clock, with implications at all stages of life. Embryos and babies experience aging. What then of people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s? What of those individuals who are already frail and cannot restrict their calories, go for a run, or make snow angels in the dead of winter? Is it too late for them? Not at all. But if we're all going to live longer and healthier lives, regardless of how much epigenetic drift and aging we've experienced at this moment in time, we might need some additional help.
So, David, one of the things you say a lot, is that you don't give medical advice, you don't endorse products, and you don't tell other people how to live their lives. Do you ever grow tired of always having to provide those caveats over and over again?
Well, it's part of my job, but I wake up to about a dozen emails from people asking me for advice. What should I buy? How much should I take? When should I take it? Or can you help my pet? Can you help my mother? What's a little draining, though I'm very happy to help, is when I hear very sad stories that, you know, I've got this genetic disease or my mother is dying from this or that. You know, then I want to help, but I just cannot. And the reason is that I'm not a trained doctor. I'm a PhD. I'm a researcher. So I'm not only allowed, but I'm not qualified to help with people's medical advice. But I also have to stay away from products such as supplements and not getting involved both commercially or even giving advice about those for the very reason that I want to maintain my academic independence. So when I do say something, people can trust that it's coming from the scientific literature and my scientific curiosity, not by any links I have to a company.
So at the same time, though, you've been really upfront with people about the things that you do in your own personal life to try to stay healthy. And we'll get to some of those specifics later in the book. But one of the things I don't think people realize is that you do that. You share that as a matter of being fully transparent. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, it's unusual. Certainly 15 years ago when I started being honest and transparent, it was highly unusual for a professor at Harvard Medical School. But I have a saying in my household, which is that the worst thing you can do is lie, you know, besides murder. And my kids have grown up thinking that. And that's what I live by. If somebody asks me a question, as long as it's not illegal to say so or breaches confidentiality, I will speak the truth, of course, with the caveats so there isn't any confusion. I don't do it for any other reason than I think the public has a right to know. They've paid for a lot of the research. And I think the information that I'm gathering may be useful. Now, all science begins with stories, of course. These aren't clinical trials, so I'm not going to be publishing them. But when I'm asked a question by a reporter or someone from the public, I feel like I should just be honest with them.
5. A better pill to swallow. The dream of extending human lives did not begin in the early 21st century any more than the dream of human flight began in the early 20th. Nothing begins with science. It all begins with stories. From Gilgamesh, the Sumerian king, who is said to have reigned over Uruk for 126 years, to Methuselah, the patriarch in Hebrew scriptures, who is said to have lived to the age of 969. Humanity's sacred stories testify to our deep-seated fascination with longevity. Outside myths and parables, though, we had little scientific evidence of anyone succeeding in extending their life far beyond the single-century mark. We had little hope of doing so without a deep understanding of how life works. That is knowledge, albeit still imperfect, that some of my colleagues and I believe we finally possess. It wasn't until 1665 that England's Leonardo, Robert Hooke, published Micrographia, in which he reported seeing cells in cork bark. That discovery
launched us into the modern era of biology. But centuries would pass before we had any clue about how cells work at the molecular scale. That knowledge could come only from the combination of a series of great leaps in microscopy, chemistry, physics, genetics, nanoengineering, and computing power. To understand how aging occurs, we must journey down into the subcellular nano world, heading down to the cell, piercing the outer membrane, and traveling into the nucleus. From there, we head down to the scale of amino acids and DNA. At this size, it is obvious why we don't live forever. Until we understood life at the nanoscale, even why we live was a mystery. The brilliant Austrian theoretical physicist Erwin Schrödinger, the man who developed quantum physics, and yes, that famous thought experiment involving a both dead and alive cat, was flummoxed when he tried to explain life. In 1944, he threw up his hands and declared that living matter is likely to involve other laws of physics hitherto unknown. That was the best he could do at the time. But things moved quickly in the decades to come, and today, the answer to Schrödinger's 1944 book, What is Life?, if not fully answered, is certainly close to being so. Turns out there is no new law required to explain life. At the nanoscale, it is merely an ordered set of chemical reactions, concentrating and assembling atoms that would normally never assemble, or breaking apart molecules that would normally never disintegrate. Life does this using proteinaceous Pac-Men called enzymes, made up of coils and layered mats of amino acid chains. Enzymes make life possible by taking advantage of fortuitous molecular movements. Every second you are alive, thousands of glucose molecules are captured within each of your trillions of cells by an enzyme called glucokinase, which fuses glucose molecules to phosphorus atoms, tagging them for energy production. Most of the energy created is used by a multi-component RNA and protein complex called a ribosome, whose primary job is to capture amino acids and fuse them with other amino acids to make fresh proteins. Does this sort of talk make your eyes gloss over? You are not alone, and you are not to blame. We teachers have done society a great disservice by making cool science boring. Textbooks and scientific papers depict biology as a static, two-dimensional world. Chemicals are drawn as sticks. Biochemical pathways are arrows. DNA is a line. A gene is a rectangle, and enzymes are ovals, drawn thousands of times larger relative to the cell than they actually are. But once you understand how cells actually work, they are the most amazing things. The problem with conveying this wonder in a classroom is that cells exist in four dimensions and buzz around with speeds and on scales we humans cannot perceive or even conceive. To us, the second and the millimeter are short divisions of time and space. But to an enzyme about 10 nanometers across and vibrating every quadrillionth of a second, a millimeter is the size of a continent, and a second is more than a year. Consider catalase, a ubiquitous, regular-sized enzyme that can break apart and detoxify 10,000 molecules of hydrogen peroxide per second. A million of them could fit inside an E. coli bacterium, a million of which could fit on the head of a pin. These numbers aren't just hard to imagine, they are inconceivable. In each cell are a total of 75,000 enzymes like catalase, all thrown together, jostling around in a slightly salty sea. At the nanoscale, water is gelatinous, and molecular events are more violent than a Category 5 hurricane, with molecules thrown together at speeds we would perceive as thousands of miles per hour. Enzymatic reactions are 1 in 1,000 events, but at the nanoscale, 1 in 1,000 events can occur thousands of times a second, enough to sustain life. If this sounds chaotic, it is, but we need this chaos for order to emerge. Without it, the molecules that must come together to sustain life would not find each other, and they would not fuse. The human sirtuin enzyme, called SIRT1, serves as a good example. Precise vibrating sockets on SIRT1 simultaneously clasp onto an NAD molecule and the protein it wants to strip the acetyls from, such as a histone or FOXO3. The two captured molecules immediately lock together, just before SIRT1 rips them apart in a different way, producing vitamin B3 and acetylated adenine ribose as waste products that are recycled back to NAD. More important is the fact that the target protein has now been stripped of the acetyl chemical group that was holding it at bay. Now the histone can pack DNA more tightly to silence genes, and FOXO3 has had its shackles removed, allowing it to go turn on a defense program of protective genes. If the chaos ended and our enzymes suddenly stopped doing what they do, we would all be dead within a few seconds. Without energy and cell defenses, there can be no life. M. superstes would never have emerged from the scum, and its descendants would never have been capable of comprehending the words in this book. And so, at the fundamental level, life is rather simple. We exist by the grace of an order created from chaos. When we toast to life, we really should be toasting to enzymes. By studying life at this level, we've also learned something rather important, something the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman expressed succinctly. There is nothing in biology yet found that indicates the inevitability of death. This suggests to me that it is not at all inevitable and that it is only a matter of time before biologists discover what it is that is causing us the trouble. It's true, there are no biological, chemical, or physical laws that say life must end. Yes, aging is an increase in entropy, a loss of information leading to disorder. But living things are not closed systems. Life can potentially last forever as long as it can preserve critical biological information and absorb energy from somewhere in the universe. This doesn't mean we could be immortal tomorrow, no more than we could have flown to the moon on December 18, 1903. Science moves forward with small steps and big steps, but always one step at a time. Here's the remarkable thing. The first steps have actually been available to us since the times of Gilgamesh and Methuselah, and indeed from the time of M. superstes. And, in the past few centuries, and by accident even earlier than that, we have discovered ways to chemically modulate enzymes with molecules we call medicines. Now that we know how life works and have the tools to change it at a genetic and epigenetic level, we can build upon this very old wisdom. And when it comes to the goal of extending healthy lifespans, the easiest measures to use are the various drugs that we already know can impact human aging. The world's greatest Easter egg. Rapa Nui, a remote volcanic island 2,300 miles west of Chile, is commonly known as Easter Island, and even better known for the nearly 900 giant stone heads that line the island's perimeter. What should be just as well known, and perhaps one day will be, is the story of how the island came to be the source of the world's most effective lifespan-extending molecule. Back in the 1960s, a team of scientists traveled to the island. The researchers were not archaeologists seeking answers about the origin of the Moai statues, but rather biologists looking for endemic microorganisms. In the dirt beneath one of the island's famed stone heads, they discovered a new actinobacterium. That single-celled organism was Streptomyces hygroscopicus, and when it was isolated by a pharmaceutical researcher, Søren Segal, it soon became clear that the actinobacterium secreted an antifungal compound. Segal named that compound rapamycin in honor of the island where it was discovered and began looking for ways to process it as a potential remedy for fungal conditions such as athlete's foot. The compound looked promising for that purpose, but when the Montreal lab where Segal worked was shuttered in 1983, he was directed to destroy the compound. He couldn't bring himself to do that, though. Instead, he spirited a few vials of the bacterium out of the lab and kept them in his freezer at home until the late 1980s, when he convinced his bosses at a new lab in New Jersey to let him resume studying it. It wasn't long before researchers discovered that the compound was an effective suppressor of the immune system, That would end its potential as an antifungal. There are plenty of remedies for athlete's foot that don't come at the cost of lowered immunity, but it gave scientists a new attribute to study. Even in the 1960s, researchers knew that one of the most common reasons for an organ transplant to fail is that the recipient patient's body rejects it. Could rapamycin lower the immune response enough to ensure the organ would be accepted? Indeed, it could. It is for this reason that if you were to make a pilgrimage to Rapa Nui, you might come upon a small plaque at the site where S. hydroscopicus was discovered. At this site, the plaque reads in Portuguese, soil samples were obtained in January 1965 that allowed the production of rapamycin, a substance that inaugurated a new era for patients who need organ transplants. I suspect that a larger plaque may soon be in order, because the discovery of S. hydroscopicus set into motion a tremendous amount of research, much of which is still going on, and some of which has the potential to prolong vitality for countless other people. Because in recent years, it has become clear that rapamycin isn't just an antifungal compound, and it isn't just an immune system suppressor. It is also one of the most consistently successful compounds for extending life. We know this from experiments on a diverse menagerie of model organisms in labs around the world. And much as my own research began with experiments with yeast, much of the initial work that has been done to understand rapamycin was completed on S. cerevisiae. If you put 2,000 normal yeast cells into a culture, a few will remain viable after 6 weeks. But if you feed those yeast cells rapamycin, in 6 weeks, about half will still be healthy. The drug will also increase the number of daughter cells mothers can produce by stimulating the production of NAD. Fruit flies fed rapamycin live about 5% longer, and small doses of rapamycin given to mice when they are already in the final months of their normal lives result in 9 to 14% longer lives, depending on whether they are male or female, which translates to about a decade of healthy human life. We've known for a long time that greater parental age is a risk factor for disease in the next generation. That's the power of epigenetics. But mice treated with rapamycin buck this trend. When researchers from the German Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases inhibited mTOR in mice born to older fathers, the negative impact of having an old parent went away. Want to know what the world's most prominent arbiters of great science think about the potential of mTOR and the molecules that inhibit it to change the world? The three men who discovered mTOR in yeast, Joseph Heitmann, Michael Hall, and Rao Mova, are on a lot of people's shortlists for the Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology. My colleague across the river at MIT, David Sabatini, who identified mTOR, was named a Clarivate Citation Laureate for having his work cited most frequently in top-tier peer-reviewed journals. The Clarivate list has predicted more than 40 Nobel Prize winners since 2002. Rapamycin isn't a panacea. Longer-lived animals might not fare as well on it as shorter-lived ones do. It's been shown to be toxic to kidneys at high doses over extended periods of time, and it might suppress the immune system over time. That doesn't mean mTOR inhibition is a dead end, though. It might be safe in small or intermittent doses. That worked in mice to extend lifespan, and in humans, dramatically improved the immune responses of elderly people to a flu vaccine. There are hundreds of researchers from the mTOR inhibition side of the family working in universities and biotech companies to identify rapalogs, which are compounds that act on mTOR in ways similar to rapamycin but have greater specificity and less toxicity. The quality of people involved in this line of research and development makes it hard to bet against mTOR inhibition as a pathway to greater human health and vitality. But even if rapalogs don't pan out, there's another pharmaceutical pathway to prolonged vitality that has already been proven to be both effective and relatively safe. Pennies for prolonged vitality. Galega officinalis is a lovely flower, with stacks of delicate purple petals that seem locked in a reverent bow to the world. Also known as goat's rue, a rather unfortunate name, and French lilac, a far more charming sobriquet, it has been used as an herbal medicine in Europe for centuries, owing to a chemical composition rich in guanidine, a small chemical in human urine that serves as an indicator of healthy protein metabolism. In the 1920s, doctors began to prescribe guanidine as a way to lower blood glucose levels in patients with diabetes. In 1922, a 14-year-old boy named Leonard Thompson, who was dying in a Toronto hospital, became the first diabetic patient to be given an injection of a novel pancreatic peptide hormone that had shown great promise in animal studies. 2 weeks later, he was given another, and news of his exceptional improvement spread quickly around the world. Type 1 diabetes, which occurs when the pancreas doesn't produce enough of the hormone needed to alert the body to sugar, is now widely treated by supplemental insulin. But the fight was not over. The type 2 version of the disease, so-called age-associated diabetes, occurs when the pancreas is able to make enough insulin, but the body is deaf to it. The 9% of all adults globally with this disease need a drug that restores their body's sensitivity to insulin so cells take up and use the sugar that's coursing through their bloodstreams. That's important for at least two reasons. It gives the overworked pancreas a rest, and it prevents spikes of freely floating sugar from essentially caramelizing proteins in the body. Recent results indicate high blood sugar can also speed up the epigenetic clock. Thanks to an increasingly sedentary lifestyle and the abundance of sugars and carbohydrates on every supermarket shelf around the globe, high blood sugar is causing the premature deaths of 3.8 million people a year. These deaths do not come quickly and compassionately, but in horrific ways, with blindness, kidney failure, stroke, open foot wounds, and limb amputations. As they considered this disease in the mid-1950s, the pharmacist Jean Aron and the physician Jean Stern, both Frenchmen who would have been exceptionally familiar with the purple flowering plant so ubiquitous in their native land, decided to reinvestigate the potential of French lilac derivatives to fight type 2 diabetes in ways insulin doesn't. In 1957, Stern published a paper demonstrating the effectiveness of oral dimethyl biguanide to treat type 2 diabetes. The drug, now most commonly called metformin, has since become one of the most widely taken and effective medicines on the globe. It's among the medications on the World Health Organization's model list of essential medicines, a catalogue of the most effective, safe, and cost-effective therapies for the world's most prevalent medical conditions. As a generic medication, it costs patients less than $5 a month in most of the world. Except for an extremely rare condition called lactic acidosis, the most common of the side effects is some stomach discomfort. Many people mitigate that side effect by taking the medication as a coated tablet or with a glass of milk or a meal. But even when that doesn't work, the mild upset feeling comes with a bit of a side benefit. It tends to discourage overeating. What place does a diabetes medication have in a conversation about prolonging vitality? Perhaps it would have no place at all if not for the fact that a few years ago researchers noticed a curious phenomenon. People taking metformin were living notably healthier lives, independent, it seemed, of its effect on diabetes. In mice, even a very low dose of metformin has been shown by Rafael DiCarbo's lab at the National Institutes of Health to increase lifespan by nearly 6%, though some have argued that the effect is due mostly to weight loss. Either way, that amounts to the equivalent of 5 extra healthy years for humans, with an emphasis on healthy. The mice showed reduced LDL cholesterol levels and improved physical performance. As the years have gone by, the evidence has mounted. In 26 studies of rodents treated with metformin, 25 showed protection from cancer. Like rapamycin, metformin mimics aspects of calorie restriction. But instead of inhibiting TOR, it limits the metabolic reactions in mitochondria, slowing down the process by which our cellular powerhouses convert macronutrients into energy. The result is the activation of AMPK, an enzyme known for its ability to respond to low energy levels and restore the function of mitochondria. It also activates SIRT1, one of my lab's favorite proteins. Among other beneficial effects, metformin inhibits cancer cell metabolism, increases mitochondrial activity, and removes misfolded proteins. A study of more than 41,000 metformin users between the ages of 68 and 81 concluded that metformin reduced the likelihood of dementia, cardiovascular disease, cancer, frailty, and depression, and not by a small amount. In one group of already frail subjects, metformin use over the course of 9 years reduced dementia by 4%, depression by 16%, cardiovascular disease by 19%, frailty by 24%, and cancer by 4%. In other studies, the protective power of metformin against cancer has been far greater than that. Though not all cancers are suppressed, prostate, bladder, renal, and esophageal cancer seem recalcitrant, more than 25 studies have shown a powerful protective effect, sometimes as great as 40% lower risk, most notably for lung, colorectal, pancreatic, and breast cancer. These aren't just numbers. These are people whose lives were markedly improved by using a single, safe drug that costs less than a cup of bad coffee. If all metformin could do was reduce cancer incidence, it would still be worth prescribing widely. In the United States, the lifetime risk of being diagnosed with cancer is greater than 40%. But there's a dividend beyond preventing cancer directly, a side effect of living longer that most people don't consider. After age 90, your chances of dying of cancer drop considerably. Of course, people will still die of other conditions, but the tremendous pain and costs associated with cancer would be significantly mitigated. The beauty of metformin is that it impacts many diseases. Through the power of AMPK activation, it makes more NAD and turns on sirtuins and other defenses against aging as a whole, engaging the survival circuit upstream of these conditions, ostensibly slowing the loss of epigenetic information and keeping metabolism in check so all organs stay younger and healthier. Most of us assume that the effects of a pill like metformin would take years to produce any appreciable effect on aging, but maybe not. An admittedly small study of healthy volunteers claimed that the DNA methylation age of blood cells is reversed within a week, and astoundingly, only 10 hours after taking a single 850 milligram pill of metformin. But clearly more work is needed with greater numbers of subjects to know for sure if metformin can delay the aging clock over the long run. In most countries, metformin isn't yet prescriptable as an anti-aging drug, but for the hundreds of millions of people around the world who are diabetic, it's not a hard prescription to get. In some places, such as Thailand, metformin is even available over-the-counter at every pharmacy for just a few cents a pill. In the rest of the world, even if you have pre-diabetes, it can be challenging to convince a doctor to prescribe you metformin. If you've been good to your body, and greater than 93.5% of your blood's hemoglobin isn't irreversibly bound to glucose, meaning it's mostly the HbA1 type, not HbA1c, you're out of luck. Not just because the majority of physicians don't know the data I just shared with you, but because even if they did, aging isn't yet considered a disease. Among the people taking metformin and leading the charge to evaluate its long-term effects on aging in humans is Nir Barzilai, the Israeli-American physician and geneticist who, along with his colleagues at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, discovered several longevity gene variants in the insulin-like growth hormone receptor that controls FOXO3, the cholesterol gene CETP, and the sirtuin SIRT6, all of which seem to help ensure that some lucky people with Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry remain healthy beyond 100. Yes, although genes play a backseat role to the epigenome, it does seem that some people are genetically primed for longevity at the digital level, enjoying longer lives almost irrespective of how they live, thanks in part to gene variants that stabilize their epigenomes, preventing the loss of analog information over time. But Barzilai doesn't see these people as winners so much as markers. They represent the potential that most other humans have for long and healthy lives. And he is fond of pointing out that even if we were to never extend lives past 120, we know that 120 is possible. So for most of us, he's told me, there are 40 good years still on the table. Barzilai is leading the charge to make metformin the first drug to be approved to delay the most common age-related diseases by addressing their root cause, aging itself. If Barzilay and his colleagues can show metformin has measurable benefits in the ongoing Targeting Aging with Metformin TAME study, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has agreed to consider aging as a treatable condition. That would be a game changer, the beginning of the end for a world in which aging is just the way it goes. Barzilay believes that day is coming. He has predicted that the traditional Hebrew blessing, Admea Vaserim Shana, or may you live until 120, may soon need updating, for it will be a wish not for a long life, but for a very average one. Stack it up. Back in 1999, the story of the sirtuin longevity pathway we discovered in Lenny Gerenti's lab at MIT was about to get even hotter. We had finally figured out a molecular cause of aging in yeast cells, the first for any species. We were still feeling the glow scientists get when they publish new work that shows how smart they are. In a series of prominent papers that had captured the imagination of the scientific community, we'd reported that the cause of yeast aging was the movement of sirtuin away from the mating type genes to deal with DNA breaks and a whole lot of ensuing genome instability. We'd shown that extra copies of the sirtuin gene could stabilize the rDNA and extend lifespan. We'd linked genetic instability to epigenetic instability and found one of the world's first true longevity genes, and the yeast hadn't had to go hungry to receive its benefits. But splicing extra copies of a gene into a single-celled organism is a much easier endeavor than putting those copies into more complex creatures. It's also far less ethically complicated. That's why a few other researchers and I entered a scientific race to find ways to ramp up sirtuin activity in mammals without inserting extra sirtuin genes. Here's where science becomes a matter of logical guesswork and some good old-fashioned luck. Because there are more than 100 million chemicals known to science, where do you even start? Thankfully, Conrad Howitz was on the case. The Cornell-educated biochemist was then the director of molecular biology for BioMol, a Pennsylvania company that was a supplier of molecules for life science researchers. Howitz was looking for chemicals that would inhibit the SIRT1 enzyme so they could be sold to the growing number of scientists who were starting to study the enzyme. In the process of evaluating different contenders, he found two chemicals that, rather than inhibiting SIRT1, stimulated or activated it, making it work 10 times as fast. That was a serendipitous discovery, not only because he was expecting to find inhibitors, but because activators are very rare in nature. They are so rare, in fact, that most drug companies don't even bother following up when one is discovered, figuring it must be a mistake. The first SIRT1 activating compound, or STAC, was a polyphenol called fizetin, which helps give plants such as strawberries and persimmons their color and is now known to also kill senescent cells. The second was a molecule called butene, which can be found in numerous flowering plants, as well as a toxic plant known as the Chinese lacquer tree. Both had a significant effect on SIRT1, though not the sort of pedal-to-the-metal reaction that might make them ripe for further research. Howitz showed his initial results to BioMol's founder and scientific director, Robert Zipkin, a brilliant chemist and entrepreneur who has an encyclopedic knowledge of chemical structures. Fizetin and butene? Huh, Zipkin said. You know what those two molecules look like? They've got an overlapping structure. Two phenolic rings connected by a bridge. You know what else has that structure? Resveratrol. In 2002, antioxidants were all the rage. They might not have been the anti-aging and health panacea some believed them to be, but that wasn't yet known. One of the antioxidants, scientists from the Karol Marcinkowski University of Medical Sciences, now Poznan University of Medical Sciences in Poland, had learned was resveratrol, a natural molecule that is found in red wine and that many plants produce in times of stress. A few researchers had suggested that resveratrol might explain the French paradox, the fact that the French have lower rates of heart disease even though their diet is relatively high in foods containing saturated fat such as butter and cheese. Zipkin's guess that resveratrol might have a similar effect as fizetin and butene was right on the money. When I studied it in my lab at Harvard, I saw that it actually far outperformed the other two molecules. As a reminder, aging in yeast is often measured by the number of times a mother cell divides to produce daughter cells. In most cases, a yeast cell gets to about 25 divisions before it dies. Because the experiments required a week of micromanipulation of cells while looking down a microscope, and the fewer times you put the cells in the fridge to get some sleep, the longer the yeast cells live, I assembled a lab at home on my dining room table. There, I saw something incredible. The resveratrol-fed yeast was slightly smaller and grew slightly more slowly than untreated yeast, getting to an average of 34 divisions before dying, as though they were calorie-restricted. The human equivalent would be an extra 50 years of life. We saw increases in maximum lifespan, too. On resveratrol, they kept going past 35. We tested resveratrol in yeast cells with no SIRT2 gene, and there was no effect. We tested it on calorie-restricted yeast and saw no further increase in lifespan, suggesting that the same pathway was being activated. This was how calorie restriction was working. It seemed like a joke's punchline. Not only had we found a calorie restriction mimetic, something that could extend longevity without hunger, but we'd found it in a bottle of red wine. Howitz and I were fascinated by the fact that resveratrol is produced in greater quantities by grapes and other plants experiencing stress. We also knew that many other health-promoting molecules and chemical derivatives of them are produced in abundance by stressed plants. We get resveratrol from grapes, aspirin from willow bark, metformin from lilacs, epigallocatechin gallate from green tea, quercetin from fruits, and allicin from garlic. This, we believe, is evidence of xenohormesis, the idea that stressed plants produce chemicals for themselves that tell their cells to hunger down and survive. Plants have survival circuits too, and we think we might have evolved to sense the chemicals they produce in times of stress as an early warning system of sorts to alert our bodies to hunker down as well. What this means, if it's true, is that when we search for new drugs from the natural world, we should be searching the stressed out ones, in stressed plants, in stressed fungi, and even in the stressed microbiome populations in our guts. The theory is also relevant to the foods we eat. Plants that are stressed have higher concentrations of xenohormetic molecules that may help us engage our own survival circuits. Look for the most highly colored ones, because xenohormetic molecules are often yellow, red, orange, or blue. One added benefit, they tend to taste better. The best wines in the world are produced in dry, sun-exposed soil or from stress-sensitive varietals such as Pinot Noir. As you might guess, they also contain the most resveratrol. The most delectable strawberries are those that have been stressed by periods of limited water supply. And as anyone who has grown leaf vegetables can attest, the best heads of lettuce come when the plants are exposed to a 1-2 combo punch of heat and cold. Ever wonder why organic foods, which are often grown under more stressful conditions, might be better for you? Resveratrol extended the lifespan of simple yeast cells, but would it do the same for other organisms? When my fellow researcher Mark Tater of Brown University visited me in Boston, I gave him a small vial of white, fluffy resveratrol powder, marked only with the letter R, to try on insects in his lab. He took it back to Rhode Island, mixed it with some yeast paste, and fed it to his fruit flies. A few months later, I got a call from him. "David," he said, "what is this R stuff?" Under lab conditions, the fruit fly Drosophila melanogaster typically lives for an average of 40 or so days. "We added a week to their lives, and sometimes more than that," Tater told me. "On average, they're living for more than 50 days. In human terms, that's an additional 14 years. In my lab, resveratrol-fed roundworms also lived longer, an effect that required the worm sirtuin gene to be engaged. And when we gave resveratrol to human cells in culture dishes, they became resistant to DNA damage. Later, when we fed resveratrol to obese mice at 1 year of age, something interesting happened. The mice stayed fat, causing postdoctoral fellow Joseph Bauer, now a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, to conclude I'd wasted more than a year of his time, jeopardizing his scientific career with a harebrained experiment. But when he and Rafael DiCarbo, our collaborator at the NIH, opened up the mice, they were shocked. The resveratrol mice looked identical to mice on a normal diet, with healthy hearts, livers, arteries, and muscles. They also had more mitochondria, less inflammation, and lower blood sugar levels. The ones they didn't dissect wound up living about 20% longer than normal. Other researchers went on to show in hundreds of published studies that resveratrol protects mice against dozens of diseases, including a variety of cancers, heart disease, stroke and heart attacks, neurodegeneration, inflammatory diseases, and wound healing, and generally makes mice healthier and more resilient. And in collaboration with DiCarbo, we discovered that when resveratrol is combined with intermittent fasting, it can greatly extend both average and maximum lifespan, even beyond what fasting alone accomplishes. Out of 50 mice, one lived more than 3 years. In human terms, that would amount to about 115 years. The first paper on resveratrol's effects on aging went on to be one of the most highly cited papers of 2006 and was widely circulated in the mainstream media too. We were all over TV, and I was starting to be recognized in public. I ran off to the little German village called Borlo, where my wife was born, and the news had even made it there. Sales of red wine reportedly went up 30%. If you like red wine, but needed a good excuse to imbibe, you can thank Rob Zipkin. On our kitchen wall hangs a variety of cartoons from the day. My favorite is one by Tom Tolles. In it, a wife tries to downplay the enthusiasm of her very large husband, who covers most of a couch. The study said that to get to the same dose as they gave the mice, you'd have to drink between 750 and 1,000 glasses of red wine every day, the wife says. The news just keeps getting better and better, the husband replies. As it turned out, resveratrol wasn't very potent and wasn't very soluble in the human gut, two attributes that most medicines need to be effective at treating diseases. Despite its limitations as a drug, it did serve as an important first proof that a molecule can give the benefits of calorie restriction without the subject having to go hungry, and it set off a global race to find other molecules that might delay aging. Finally, at least in scientific circles, slowing aging with a drug was no longer considered bonkers. By studying resveratrol, we also learned that it is possible to activate sirtuins with a chemical. This prompted a flood of research into other sirtuin-activating compounds called STACs that are many times more potent than resveratrol at stimulating the survival circuit and extending healthy lifespans in animals. They go by names such as SRT1720 and SRT2104, both of which extended the healthy lifespan of mice when given to them late in life. There are today hundreds of chemicals that have been demonstrated to have an effect on sirtuins that are even more effective than resveratrols, and some that have already been demonstrated in clinical trials to lower fatty acid and cholesterol levels and to treat psoriasis in humans. Another stack is NAD, sometimes written as NAD+. NAD has an advantage over other stacks because it boosts the activity of all seven sirtuins. NAD was discovered in the early 20th century as an alcoholic fermentation enhancer. That was fortuitous. If it hadn't had the potential to improve the way we make booze, scientists might not have been so enamored by it. Instead, they worked on it for decades, and in 1938, they had a breakthrough. NAD was able to cure black tongue disease in dogs, the canine equivalent of pellagra. It turned out that NAD is a product of the vitamin niacin, a severe lack of which causes inflamed skin, diarrhea, dementia, skin sores, and ultimately death. And because NAD is used by over 500 different enzymes, without any NAD, we'd be dead in 30 seconds. By the 1960s, however, researchers had concluded that all the interesting research on NAD had been done. For decades to come, NAD was simply a housekeeping chemical that teenage biology students had to learn about, with all the enthusiasm of a teenager doing housekeeping. That all changed in the 1990s when we began to realize that NAD wasn't just keeping things running. It was a central regulator of many major biological processes, including aging and disease. That's because Shinichiro Imai and Lenny Gorenti showed that NAD acts as fuel for sirtuins. Without sufficient NAD, the sirtuins don't work efficiently. They can't remove the acetyl groups from histones, they can't silence genes, and they can't extend lifespan. And we sure wouldn't have seen the lifespan extending impact of the activator resveratrol. We and others also noticed that NAD levels decrease with age throughout the body, in the brain, blood, muscle, immune cells, pancreas, skin, and even the endothelial cells that coat the inside of microscopic blood vessels. But because it's so central to so many fundamental cellular processes, no researchers in the 20th century had any interest in testing the effects of boosting levels of NAD. Bad stuff will happen if you mess with NAD, they thought. But not even having tried to manipulate it, they didn't really know what would happen if they did. The benefit of working with yeast, though, is that the worst-case scenario in any experiment is a yeast massacre. There was little risk in looking for ways to boost NAD in yeast, so that's what my lab members and I did. The easiest way was to identify the genes that make NAD in yeast. We first discovered a gene called PNC1, which turns vitamin B3 into NAD. That led us to try boosting PNC1 by introducing 4 extra copies of it into the yeast cells, giving them 5 copies in total. Those yeast cells lived 50% longer than normal, but not if we removed the SIRT2 gene. The cells were making extra NAD, and the sirtuin survival circuit was being engaged. Could we do this in humans? Theoretically, yes. We already have the technology to do it in my lab, using viruses to deliver the human equivalent of the PNC1 gene called NAMPT. But turning humans into transgenic organisms requires more paperwork and considerably more knowledge about safety, for the stakes are higher than a yeast massacre. That's why we once again began searching for safe molecules that could achieve the same result. Charles Brenner, who is now the head of biochemistry at the University of Iowa, discovered in 2004 that a form of vitamin B3 called nicotinamide riboside, or NR, is a vital precursor of NAD. He later found that NR, which is found in trace levels in milk, can extend the lifespan of yeast cells by boosting NAD and increasing the activity of SIRT2. Once a rare chemical, NR is now sold by the ton each month as a nutraceutical. Meanwhile, on a parallel path, researchers, including us, were homing in on a chemical called nicotinamide mononucleotide, or NMN, a compound made by our cells and found in foods such as avocado, broccoli, and cabbage. In the body, NR is converted into NMN, which is then converted into NAD. Give an animal a drink with NR or NMN in it, and the levels of NAD in its body go up about 25% over the next couple of hours, about the same as if it had been fasting or exercising a great deal. My friend from the Gorenti lab, Shinichiro Imai, demonstrated in 2011 that NMN could treat the symptoms of type 2 diabetes in old mice by restoring NAD levels. Then researchers in my lab at Harvard showed we could make the mitochondria in old mice function just like mitochondria in young mice after just a week of NMN injections. In 2016, my other lab at the University of New South Wales collaborated with Margaret Morris to demonstrate that NMN treats a form of type 2 diabetes in obese female mice and their diabetes-prone offspring. And back at Harvard, we found that NMN could give old mice the endurance of young mice and then some, leading to the great mouse treadmill failure of 2017, when we had to reset the tracking program on our lab's miniature exercise machines because no one had expected that an elderly mouse or any mouse could run anywhere near 3 kilometers. This molecule doesn't just turn old mice into ultramarathoners. We have used NMN-treated mice in studies that tested their balance, coordination, speed, strength, and memory too. The difference between the mice that were on the molecule and the mice that were not was astounding. Were they human, those rodents would long since have been eligible for senior citizen discounts. nicotinamide mononucleotide turned them into the equivalent of contenders on American Ninja Warrior. Other labs have shown that NMN can protect against kidney damage, neurodegeneration, mitochondrial diseases, and an inherited disease called Friedreich's ataxia that lands active 20-year-olds in wheelchairs. As I write this, a group of mice that were put on NMN late in life are getting very old. In fact, only 7 out of the original 40 mice are still alive, but they are all healthy and still moving happily around the cage. The number of mice alive that didn't get the NMN? 0. Every day I'm asked by members of the public, which is the superior molecule, NR or NMN? We find NMN to be more stable than NR and see some health benefits in mouse experiments that aren't seen when NR is used. But it's NR that has been proven to extend the lifespan of mice. NMN is still being tested. So there's no definitive answer, at least not yet. Human studies with NAD boosters are ongoing. So far, there has been no toxicity, not even a hint of it. Studies to test its effectiveness in muscle and neurological diseases are in progress or about to begin, followed by super NAD boosting molecules that are a couple of years behind them in development. But a lot of people haven't been content to wait for these studies, which can take years to play out. And that has given us some interesting leads about where these molecules, or ones like them, might take us. See page 10 in the PDF. Fertile ground. We know that NAD boosters are an effective treatment for a wide variety of ailments in mice, and that they extend their lifespan even when given late in life. We know that emerging research strongly suggests they could have a similar, if not duplicative, effect on human health. We also know that the way it does this, in terms of the epigenetic landscape, is by creating the right level of stress, just enough to push our longevity genes into action to suppress epigenetic changes to maintain the youthful program. In doing so, NMN and other vitality molecules, including metformin and rapamycin, reduce the buildup of informational noise that causes aging, thus restoring the program. How do they do this? We are still working to understand how epigenetic noise is dampened at a molecular level, but we know in principle how it works. When we give silencing proteins such as sirtuins a boost, they can maintain the youthful epigenome even with DNA damage occurring, like the long-lived yeast cells with extra copies of the sirtuin gene. Somehow they can cope with it. Perhaps they are just super efficient at repairing DNA breaks and head home before they get lost. Or if half the sirtuins head off, the remaining enzymes can hold down the fort. Either way, the increased activity of the sirtuins may prevent Waddington's marbles from escaping their valleys. And even if they have started to head out of the valley, molecules such as NMN may push them back down like extra gravity. In essence, this would be age reversal in some parts of the body. A small step, but age reversal nonetheless. One of the first clues this might be true in an animal larger than a mouse came when a student who works in my lab at Harvard came into my office one afternoon. "David," he said quietly, "do you have a moment? There's something I need to discuss. It's about my mother." Given the expression on his face and the tone of his voice, I immediately worried that my student, who came from another country, would tell me his mother was sick. Having been half a planet away from my mother when she was dying, I very much knew how that felt. "Whatever you need," I blurted out. The student seemed taken aback, and I realized I hadn't yet posed the most pertinent question. "Is your mother all right?" I asked. "Yes," he said. "Well, I mean, yes, well, mostly." He reminded me that his mother had been taking supplemental NMN, as some of my students and their family members do. "The thing is, well," his voice lowered to a whisper, "she has started her, cycle again." It took me a few seconds to realize what cycle he was talking about. As women approach and go through menopause, the menstrual cycle can become quite irregular, which is why a year with no periods must go by before most doctors will confirm that menopause has occurred. After that, such bleeding can be a cause for concern, as it could be a sign of cancer, fibroid tumors, infections, or an adverse reaction to a medication. Has she been seen by a doctor? I asked. Yes, my student said again. The doctors say there's nothing wrong. They said this just looks like a normal period. I was intrigued.